This is The End User, episode 90 for Thursday, April 12th, Quarter Whale Fail. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Taylor Marr. So, Chris, I think the big news this week was sort of a joke. It was Facebook bought Instagram for $1 billion. And that's not the joke, but the joke is, well, what's the best joke that you heard or came up with about this deal? I heard a lot of good ones.
Wait, that's not a joke?
Well, not really, no. It's just sort of an oddball business deal.
You're telling me Instagram is actually worth $1 billion to somebody?
Well, so I heard somebody say, oh, those idiots, they could have downloaded it for free.
That's pretty good.
$1 billion? I could have smeared mustard all over your photos for half of that.
Yeah, so you should make an app called Mustard something or other so that you can compete with Instagram, except for you can make it more yellow or something.
I'll work on that.
As a joke.
Yellowgram.
Yellowgram. It'll be like that. It'll be like that I Am Rich app. Remember that, the one with the big ruby that didn't actually do anything but cost $1,000. I think that's a good business plan for you.
I'll work on that.
Yeah. So Instagram is worth $1 billion. I can't believe it. We talked about it last week on the podcast. That because Instagram was coming to Android. And it wasn't previously on Android, so we had to talk about it then, and we kind of dismissed it. And, you know, it's really popular.
Right. Well, here's why I think that Facebook would decide to want to pay $1 billion for a company like Instagram. So it is really popular. They have a lot of people who are using it, and those people that use it, they share pictures like people used to share Facebook updates. Like, right. it's no big deal for your average Instagram user to share like 5-10 pictures a day.
I could see that. Do you think there's some cross section of the market where they don't use Twitter or something like that? So I could see somebody using Facebook and Instagram and using Instagram as like a pseudo photo Twitter thing.
My sister and the majority of her friends tend to use Instagram almost exclusively and then connect Instagram to Facebook.
Interesting. So I guess it just makes it easy. See, the thing is I don't share a whole lot of photos in the first place, so maybe that's why I don't get it.
You don't share a whole lot of photos because you're not in the habit of using Instagram.
Yeah, so maybe it's a chicken and the egg thing. Maybe if you want to
share something and your default sharing app is Instagram, then you just share photos.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, what am I going to do? Take a picture of my feet while I'm walking down the street?
Yeah, people do that.
Oh, well, I don't want to see that. it still doesn't work on my phone, so I guess I'll have to wait and either figure it out or you know, when I get a new phone, maybe I can do some experiments and see if I can get it to stick.
Or you could just buy them for $1 billion.
Yeah, I got $1 billion in cash laying around in ones so I can swim in it.
Well, because you can't swim in gold coins. Only Scrooge McDuck can do that.
Yeah, he has special powers. Actually, even if you tried to swim in dollar bills, they would probably paper cut you pretty badly. So I wouldn't advise that. I wouldn't advise that to the founders of Instagram, unless they want to get lots of paper bill cuts.
So what does this mean, though, for people who actually use Instagram? And what does it mean for those of us who don't?
Well, so I take away at very least one thing, and that is that Facebook doesn't seem to want to integrate it into Facebook in any meaningful way.
That's just what they're saying
to make people feel better about, oh no, you know, the big bad Facebook bought my Instagram, and you know, is it going to go away? Is it going to get sucked into Facebook or something like that. I think they're going to leave it alone, at least for now, and maybe they'll have some heavier integration into Facebook, but they're not going to leave the app behind or something like that. But that's kind of the upshot for now, is that, I guess we don't really know, other than the fact that they're leaving it alone for now. And I saw a bunch of people say, oh, it's over. I'm out of Instagram. No longer going to do that.
Yeah, I saw a couple of people too. They haven't quit yet, though.
No, it's the same crowd that says they're going to quit Facebook and then they never, and then they always come back.
I heard some Instagram quitters among the crowd that actually has quit Facebook.
Oh, right. Well, you know, there's a certain percentage of people where it actually sticks, but
yeah.
Most of those Facebook people just come right on back.
I suppose they do, yeah. So basically, the thing that everybody's talking about has very little impact on the end user this week.
Yeah, I mean, it's an announcement. You could almost read the headline and move on as if it were an afterburner. But it's such a big deal that I think the bigger deal is that it's a technology company that's being bought for $1 billion, which debatably doesn't have a useful revolutionary technology of some sort. And I think that's one of the problems is, well, okay, are we now in a technology bubble? Do you think this is a sign of a bubble, $1 billion for Instagram?
Yeah, probably. But you can never detect a bubble before it pops.
Right. So I don't know. We'll see what happens with it. And as Facebook's...
Okay, so
Go ahead.
So another thing that we should keep an eye on is a new lawsuit from the Justice Department against Apple, as well as Hachette, HarperCollins, Macmillan, Penguin, and Simon & Schuster. They claim that the publishers colluded to fix the prices of ebooks.
Shocker of all shockers. Have you ever looked at the book industry?
It is pretty confusing how ebook prices have been slowly climbing, even as physical book prices fall. And so when the Kindle and the Nook first came out, like, ebooks were cheaper than new paperbacks pretty much across the board. And now they're more expensive across the board.
Yeah, a lot of them are. And that's what's always bothered some people is that, you know, we come back to this theme a lot is the technological side of things and the social and business side of things. Because you think, well, you're not distributing this on paper. You have no printing costs. The digital price should go down. And a lot of times that ends up not being the case. So they ditch some printing costs, and then they can charge you more for the convenience of digital. That's the
right.
The business flip side of things. So it's a little bit weird that ebook prices have gone up, and I think that's kind of part of it.
But here's the canary that sets it off for me, though. Ebook prices have been going down steadily, particularly among the people who self-publish using Amazon's ebook publishing system.
Right, right.
They're selling their books for $3 or $4 or $5 or even like 99 cents or free in some cases, and still making money.
Yeah, and I think that's what digital really does, is it allows the little guy in. You know, we do this podcast on a shoestring because the technology is out there and I'm able to produce it as such. So it enables the little guy to get in there, and they can sell their stuff really cheaply and you know, even sell ads against their website or whatever it is. And if they have the passion, they can do it. They won't make...
Chris, your shoestring has great bandwidth.
Is that an analog to SneakerNet? So in the future, when we deliver the podcast, I'm no longer going to do RSS. I'm going to burn it to a CD and deliver it individually to every single person that requests it.
Oh, as our green correspondent, I can't abide by that.
No, that's a bad idea. But, you know, when you go to a digital model like that, you're letting the little guy in. If you do actually let the little guy in, it turns out Kindle did. And did iBooks? I don't remember. Do they have a self-publishing platform?
Yeah, they do. Remember, Apple had a big announcement in January.
They had that application, the iBooks Writer application or whatever it's called.
Yep.
So yeah, so they allow it too. So yeah, they're all allowing the little guy in, which is kind of nice. But this lawsuit with the DOJ is about the big guys. That almost has nothing to do with the little guys and their books being cheap, because they are the little guys and their books need to be cheap to get the audience.
Right. But the question I wonder is, you know, you got Apple on here along with the rest of the publishers. Apple's doing publishing with these guys. And then they also have the independent publishers. So I wonder why Amazon and Barnes & Noble aren't named on this list, but Apple is.
I'm not terribly sure. You know, we're not going to get into lawyerly stuff because neither of us are lawyers and we can't speak intelligently to that. But I could kind of see Amazon being left out of this because they're the good guy in this, and Barnes & Noble too. Because Apple's the one whose terms of service in iBooks say that if you sell a book in the iBook store, it has to be the cheapest version when compared to any other store. To release your iBook, you have to agree to that. And that, I think, is one of the couple issues that they're facing.
I don't know. That seems pro-consumer to me.
What, that if I decide to release an iBooks app at $4.99, that I couldn't later put it in the Kindle store for $3.99? How is that? That's not pro-consumer.
No, you drop the price to $3.99 in the Kindle store.
But what if, so the iBooks is a richer platform because of the iPad, and you can offer video and stuff like that. What if I have a premium version of the book in iBooks? I wouldn't be able to charge more for it in that case.
No, that's true.
I mean, it's a set of handcuffs. It doesn't really need to be there. I don't see why. Well, no, I do see why Apple would want to do it, because they want to be guaranteed that they have the cheapest price on the thing that they have in their market.
But all that does is it discourages innovation in the iBook store. And if Apple wants to do that, then whatever, they can do it.
Yeah, I guess that's the flip side of that, right?
Right.
And what gets me as a little weird about this is that, well, if you look at the book industry at large, it's always been kind of a colluding mess of publishers and retailers. It's always been like this.
At least since the fall of Crown Books and a lot of independent retailers.
Yeah, absolutely. You get Barnes & Noble and formerly Borders in there. And, you know, they actually are not allowed to set the price. They sell the book at whatever the publisher prints on the back of the page unless they get permission otherwise. And I just... This has been going on for a long time, and we're seeing it in ebooks. So I'm a little curious why, if we see a similar thing happening in ebooks, if all of a sudden we're concerned about it.
Well, it's something to be concerned about. Maybe it's just come to our attention now because we don't know what we're paying for anymore.
Yeah, that's likely. I mean, you look at something and it's new, and you're more likely to raise objections to it than if you look at something that's old and say, well, that's worked for so long, let's just roll with it. I don't know. Making sense of lawsuits is difficult at best, because they don't really make sense. You know, they're based upon things that could inherently be irrational, and it's hard to, as not a lawyer, it's hard to kind of suss out what is in here that could be rational and what is in here that is based upon things that are irrational, right? It's a little hard to suss those things out.
Well, I think that that illogic kind of applies better than anywhere else to the patent lawsuits between big tech companies. And with that, I think we should kick off our afterburners.
All right, give us a kickstart.
All right, so Microsoft I believe they're ensconced in a number of lawsuits at the moment, but they have signed a deal with AOL for $1 billion. We're hearing that figure a lot this week for AOL's entire patent portfolio, $1 billion just for patents. And now it's pretty clear that Microsoft has no intention of actually using any of these patents. They're just buying it for ammunition in lawsuits.
And Microsoft is going to be ending the window for Windows Vista support. So cry a tear for Vista, because you will no longer be getting support as a consumer as of April 10th. That was yesterday.
And they're cutting off mainstream support for Microsoft Office, what was it, 2007?
2007.
And they've announced end dates for any support whatsoever for Windows XP and a number of other products.
Right, and you still have 2 years for Windows XP. You will get security updates and the like. But after that, they're going to wipe their hands of it. At least for consumers. It's a little bit different for businesses, but
right. So the Nokia Lumia 900 came out on AT&T this past Sunday, as we talked about last week. But apparently an Easter Sunday phone release is not the best idea.
Yikes. Yeah, all the stores are closed. What were they thinking? It doesn't make any sense. Well, right. We'll have to wait a little while on Lumia, see what happens.
So in New York City, for example, 18 AT&T stores were closed for Easter. 19 stores didn't answer the phone, and only 2 were open, but they said they didn't have it yet.
Yikes. They really screwed that one up.
However, if you did manage to pick up the Lumia 900, you can get your $100 back. Because there is a problem that a defect is cutting off data on 3G, LTE, and Wi-Fi.
Yeah, so they had a software bug, and they're going to give you a gift card? Oh, boy.
Yeah. So the best news, actually, is that even if you go out within this next week, if you pick up the phone for $100, you'll still get $100 credit on your bill. So it actually, you get the money back in terms of your bill.
Yeah, in terms of your bill. That's really cool, actually. So you can get a free Lumia 900 if you play that hack card.
Yeah, true.
Not bad. So it looks like Verizon is going to start charging for phone upgrades. This makes me very sad as somebody who uses Verizon and likes to upgrade off contract.
I'm not super surprised. AT&T has done this, although they often waive that upgrade fee, and I believe Sprint does it as well, although I can't confirm that.
So by activating a new phone, you will be charged $30.
Yep, and that's more than AT&T, I know that. Okay, Samsung has released a new Galaxy Tab 2. They released a 7-inch version, and it's only going to be $250. Comes out in 2 weeks.
And Google Plus is getting a big refresh. Well, it has gotten a big refresh with a bunch of new UI elements, and it looks like they're cleaning things up a little bit, cleaning house, and hopefully people don't reject it too badly. They don't have the market share that Facebook does, so they at least won't get that kind of backlash. But so if you haven't looked at your Google Plus account in a while like I have, then it might be worth going and have a look and see what's new over there. They're also adding a dedicated Hangouts page, so maybe we'll do some of the end-user Hangouts in the future. I don't know. I could push the video out there.
Yeah, that'd be an interesting idea. We'd have to really revamp our social media focus. Anyway, let's turn off the afterburners before things get a little crazy.
Yes, turn them off. Let's slow down a little bit, and let's talk a bit more about the carriers. So what's going on? What's going on with this? This looks like Big Brother news to me.
Yeah, it sort of seems like it, although it sort of makes sense to me. So the FCC was pushing for an agreement between all the 4 major carriers in the U.S. To team together, pool their resources, and share them with the FCC to track stolen phones. So the networks are out there. The information is available for law enforcement to be able to track down phones that have been stolen. I've had my phone stolen and recovered before, and it had nothing to do with this.
Yeah, I So as it is right now, law enforcement can track down your cell phone. All they have to do is pay a fee. It's a pretty hefty fee, but if they fork over the money, they can track your phone if they want to. So it kind of makes sense, assuming that that is a reality in the first place, which for now it is, then it kind of makes sense to extend that nicety back to the consumer if their phone gets stolen. But what I'd really prefer is not, or at least have the option to turn this off entirely for everyone. That would be, from a security perspective, from a security of information perspective, that would be even better. I mean, people always cry when Facebook commits some kind of privacy violation. But, I mean, seriously, this is your every time location is out there for sale from the carrier to law enforcement. I mean, that's a privacy violation right there. So what I'd prefer to see is the ability to turn this off. And if I don't turn it off, then I get the ability to track down stolen phones afterwards and stuff like that.
So what if it was something like iPhones have, where it's track my iPhone? It's an option that you can turn on, and once it's turned on, you can ping the iPhone as long as it's on and available on some network.
Yeah, and you can lock it and stuff like that, and
yeah,
have it scream out.
Right, but you have to have your own log information to be able to access it.
Well, that's fine, but that's a tangent to the issue here. It's not really an issue. This has been happening for a long time.
But what if the law was just requiring that kind of software?
Well, it's fine because they don't need that kind of software to track you in the first place. All they need is a log of the cell phone towers, because your phone's unique identifier pings the cell phone tower. That's how they know where you're at. And you ping three of them, and they can triangulate you into about 10 or 30 feet or so.
So is that the kind of privacy thing that bothers you?
Yeah, I think I'm not usually one who whines about privacy, but I feel like that should be an opt-in action. You should say, well, no, you know, don't give my information to law enforcement. Well, let them take it out of, let it be required that law enforcement needs a reason to ask for this information. The only reason right now that they would not get your information is because there's a steep price tag on it. So I'm not terribly paranoid. Like, I'm not worried about it at all. But that would seem like the right thing to do to me.
Okay. Yeah, I agree. I don't think that's going to happen, though.
No, I don't think it's going to happen at all. I can say that all I want, but there's no way that's going to happen.
Right.
It's like an iPhone with a 1080p screen. People can call out the unicorn, but it's not going to come trotting in their direction.
Well, speaking of iPhones, AT&T is going to officially allow unlocking iPhones. So you have to be a customer in good standing. You have to be off contract for your phone.
Nice.
But once you do it, you can call them up or even go online and talk to them on chat. And they will confirm your account status, and then they'll send a request to Apple, and then Apple will send you an unlock code, and then you can unlock through iTunes at home.
Yeah, this is cool. So this is something that you were not able to take your iPhone and unlock it before, and now you can.
Right. Well, I mean, I have an iPhone that is off contract, in which I jailbroke and unlocked myself. Both things of which are perfectly legal. But it does definitely void the warranty, which had already expired on that phone anyway.
Yeah. Well, besides, you get to have the little hardware hackery fun, so.
No, there was no hardware hacking. It was all software.
Oh, no, I'm thinking of when you replaced the screen on it. I think it was that one.
Yeah, well, that was how I originally voided my warranty on that phone.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, this is cool. I always wondered why we even have this notion of unlocking. It seems kind of ridiculous to block the hardware from doing what it's supposed to do.
Yeah, it does seem pretty ridiculous. And I had thought that this was already available and possible, just to extremely unadvertised.
I think if you asked them to unlock your phone so that you could use it abroad, then they would unlock it.
Actually, apparently it was not in their general policies to do it anyway, because one other stipulation of unlocking iPhones, even if you're still on contract, if you are a military service member currently deployed abroad, they will unlock your phone anyway.
They'll do it for you anyway. Well, that's cool.
As long as you come back and you put your SIM card back in and you finish out your contract.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure this is the kind of thing where if you say, okay, well, I'm going somewhere, they'll just say, okay, here you go. Here's your
card. Yeah, that's something that they've done before, but now, they had not been doing it for any smartphones.
Yeah, now it's official, basically.
Right.
So if that sounds attractive to you, then you should do it. Now, when you buy a laptop, it's not locked. Why are phones like that? It's so that you can fulfill your contract, so that they can be sure that you're not going to take the phone and run.
If your laptop has a DVD player, that is region locked.
Yeah, although you can change it really easily.
But only 5 times.
Yeah, but you can change it really easily.
But once the 5 times are up, then you're done.
No, I'm pretty sure you can do it more than 5. There must be a way to work around that, right?
Well, 5 years ago when I lived abroad, I knew a lot of people who were using American DVDs and then using foreign DVDs and then American and then foreign and then American and then foreign, and then that was that.
Or even better, just leave the region alone and just rip it and break the encryption on it.
Well, yeah, but these people didn't realize that they would need to do that, and probably wouldn't have been able to in any case.
Yeah. And by the way, that is specifically illegal under the DMCA, so I would not advise that you do that. But ripping DVDs is probably, even though it's kind of legally gray, it's probably fine. It's one of those things that just hasn't been tested in court yet. Anyway, I reiterate, not a lawyer. We need like a big red sign, you know, that says, not a lawyer.
This is an audio podcast, Chris.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We need a big red audio clip that says... No, now we're getting into mixing up the senses, and that's off in the weeds.
All right. Well, we'll do a synesthesia show next week.
Yeah. Synesthesia weekly.
Ooh, that would be good. And now, for the next 5 minutes, the smell of chocolate cake in your ear.
Yes. Yes. So, speaking of chocolate cake, let's get into Windows on the iPad.
Sure. That's exactly like chocolate cake.
It's exactly like chocolate cake. It's delicious. Everybody wants it. Well, I don't know about that last part. But we talked about previously, what was that, maybe 3 weeks ago or something like that, that Microsoft and OnLive had some licensing issues because OnLive was trying to give people access to Office in a Windows 7 installation in the cloud on their iPad so that they could do whatever they want with this Office. And I guess for Windows 7 client, at least, that's against the license of Windows in this case. So they independently got together and figured out a way to bring them into compliance while still offering the service. And Microsoft undoubtedly will make a little bit of money off of this because they're in compliance. And it looks like they're going to use Windows Server 2008 R2, which is the server version of 7, to offer Office, and then they're going to skin it to look like Windows 7. How's that for a hack around?
It's just kind of funny. It just, like, why couldn't they just do Windows 7? Like, they made the deal with Microsoft.
Yeah, I mean, it's against the license. They would have to change. They would have to go back and change the Windows license to allow OnLive to do this, and potentially allowing other people to do it in the same way. I guess, I don't know. I understand what you're saying, but these things get muddled around in a big company like Microsoft.
I guess they do, but it just seems unnecessarily complicated to me.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It is unnecessarily complicated, but if you can take anything away from this, you can at least take away that you can indeed still use their servers to use Office on the iPad.
Well, here's what I take away from this. I have a Mac, so I don't have to worry about any of this stuff, including viruses.
Whoa. Slow down there.
No, okay. I don't really take that away from this. But that seems to be the point that Eric Hessendahl was making over at All Things D, right?
Yeah, this kind of thing really drives me crazy. Like I said last week when we talked about the flashback Trojan that is part of a botnet for Macs, and it's actually not specifically for Macs. Macs make up about 98% of the size of the botnet, but it's not specifically for Macs. It can be Windows as well.
So sure, but Windows had this vulnerability plugged a lot sooner than Apple did.
Yeah, because the Windows version of Java, which is the delivery vector for the virus that contributes to the botnet, is
it's updated independently from Java.
Yeah, well, it's patched by Oracle, straight from the owner of Java.
Right.
And that's not true on the Mac, because Apple is the one who does the patching.
But how many people do you know, Chris, that routinely ignore that little JavaScript update pop-up in the bottom right corner?
Or Java update. Be careful there.
Okay,
A lot of people. And that's part of the problem. Also, Apple's released a fix that fixes this bug, but one of the problems is it's 10.6 and up. So you have to have Snow Leopard.
Right. And even then, it's even more complicated for someone who doesn't want to do any of these things. Apple only prompts you once every 2 weeks or so. You say, hey, got a bunch of updates. You should download them.
Yeah, and the... what's a problem is not how... It's not what Apple's doing. It's about what some specific people in the Apple community are doing, and they're denying this like some kind of like Apollo mission deniers or something. Security exists in the real world, and I don't understand why this is a hard concept to wrap your head around. But I mean, there is a Trojan that exists through Java for Mac that has acquired 670,000 Macs to do its bidding. And I don't understand why that is a hard concept to grasp for some people, and why I see religious flame wars on Twitter about whether the Mac is secure or not. That's not important. The important part is that we tell people what is going on, how to check for it, how to fix it, and move on with our lives. We don't need this kind of religious argument, right?
Yeah, and on that note, this week in our show notes, we have a... One button click and fix to check to see if you have the flashback Trojan on your Mac and remove it if you do. That's from F-Secure.
F-Secure,
we get our
right.
tip from Lifehacker.
Excellent. And I know I think Sophos also has a removal tool as well. But
And Apple is coming out with an official fix probably within the next week.
Yeah, they should just buy it from F-Secure or something.
They probably should, but they have so many coders, they probably just want to roll their own.
Now, I thought this was an interesting, and this is the last thing we'll say about this, because, we talked about it last week, and we'll move right along. But I thought it was really interesting, because Kaspersky has, they basically set up a honeypot for the infected Mac computers, and they figured out what the next domain that the Trojan was going to phone home with was, and they figured that out and they bought the domain name and then they set up a server there to capture the traffic that was being hurled toward it, and that's how they figured out that 670,000 Macs were infected. And they also got the unique IDs. So if you go over to Kaspersky's website, they have a lookup where you can see if you are infected or if you ever were infected in the time period that they were doing their testing. So I thought that was really, that was a really neat way of doing things. Never really heard anything quite like that.
Yeah, I don't usually follow honeypot botnet methods, yeah. But it sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty neat. And I guess the moral here is that, well, you know, you need to be concerned in some way with security. Right. Whether you run antivirus or not, it's still a concern. Just keep your head up and you know, be aware of where you're surfing before you click that link or open that Excel spreadsheet or whatever it is. Right. I doubt any listeners of our podcast are really in horrible virus trouble, right?
Probably not, but there could be some out there who haven't yet checked whether they're on the flashback botnet. I can rest easy that all of our Windows using listeners have security software installed. Now it's time for our Mac listeners to think about doing the same.
Yeah, yeah. Or at least either have antivirus or use Safe Practices. It's got to be one or the other.
And Safe Practices do not just mean turning off Java on your web browser, as Mr. Hessendahl implies in his article.
Yeah, I mean, that's among other things that you could do. Turn off JavaScript. Turn off everything you possibly can turn off, but that makes the web kind of boring, doesn't it?
It certainly does, yeah.
All right, well, that's enough of that. In fact, we even went too long in that. But let's move on to our green tip of the week. I guess I'm making a green tip of the week. We also have a tip of the week, but here's the green story of the week.
Yeah, no, so green, sorry about green tech that. Is not really a tip of the week. That is, unless you're trying to build something in an extremely remote environment, like the Arctic tundra or an offshore wind turbine or something. This is itself actually a wind turbine, but it is a portable airborne turbine that's an airship, basically. So it's a helium airship that's tethered to the ground. It goes up into 300 feet, and they're making one for 1,000 feet, up into the air, and it captures the high-speed winds that are more constant up there. And so you can deploy it anywhere and get access to those high-altitude winds to power, you know, whatever it is that you couldn't otherwise get power to, somewhere where you would have previously had to use a diesel generator.
So this is
from a company called Alteros Energies, and they have a prototype that worked. It got more than twice as much power as they would have gotten on the ground.
Wow.
And it folds up into a tractor trailer truck.
I wanna fly one of these off the roof of my apartment building.
Yeah, well, so it's not exactly stable long term and not so much cost effective. You'd be better off just putting a regular wind turbine on the roof of your building.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. It's a portable solution. That's really neat. This thing looks like I get a feeling if we actually get this thing deployed anywhere, we're going to see an increase in UFO sightings. Thing looks completely alien.
It does look pretty crazy. It looks like some sort of giant deep sea fish.
Yeah, a little bit. So it looks like a quarter of a whale or something. That's what they should call it, the quarter whale.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, well, anyways, if you want to look at the picture of this flying beast, this flying quarter whale, I'm just going to roll with it. Just call it quarter whale. If you want to see a picture of the quarter whale, then you can do so at our show notes at thedigitalmediazone.com. So that's cool.
Right. So now it's time for the tip of the week, which is
now
not
it's time
exactly
for the tip
green.
Of the week, which is not green. Yeah,
it's not green, but it's not specifically green.
No, but it
so
is.
So this ties
it is a good
into
idea.
The Instagram story. If you're one of those people who's bothered by Facebook buying Instagram, you don't want to use it anymore, but you like the pictures that you took before, you can use a service called Instaport. Instaport is it's a website at instaport.me, and it takes all the pictures that you shared on Instagram, it downloads them to a zip file, or it exports them to Flickr or RSS or Facebook. But then what would be the point of that?
Yeah, well, the point is you have, with Instaport, you get the ability to have control of your own data. That's an important notion.
Right. You may have to be a little bit patient. It'll probably be up by the time you're hearing this. But it was down for almost all of the 24 hours following the Facebook, Instagram announcement.
Yeah, and like we mentioned earlier, people who are upset that Facebook, the big boy, is buying Instagram.
You know, and I feel like this is just proof that the people who are upset were not a small minority.
Not a small minority. They're going to pull their data out and go along their merry way.
That's it for the tip of the week.
I thought that this was a like an instant ship port or something like that, where just like the balloon, you know, you have some kind of air thing roll out and then you can dock a ship. But that wouldn't be
now you just want everything to be some sort of airborne whale.
Yeah, well, you know, Instaport whale. That's good.
Instaport fail whale.
Instaport, yeah. It actually was. All right, well, speaking of whales, we've got a good kicker this week, don't we?
We do, although whales can't really kick. They don't have legs. But you can kick if you're playing Konami or something.
Sure.
On the NES, because an Etsy seller has just built a functional NES controller into a coffee table. The whole thing is made of wood. It looks like a giant NES controller. And it's, I mean, you really have to see the picture, you know, just to see how pretty this thing is. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, and it works. That's the big thing. I mean,
And you can buy it. That's the really big thing, I think.
Yeah, that's
pretty
cool. It
works, and you can buy it.
Now, we just need the running pad, too, so that we can get into the Olympic Games, too.
Well, I want a coffee table-sized light gun.
Yeah, that would be cool, too. More like a bazooka.
Well, they had a bazooka back in the day for NES.
No. I mean, like, a comically oversized handgun.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. But
yeah,
it's
exactly
different from a bazooka.
No. I mean, bazooka-sized handgun. Yeah.
Right.
That makes sense. Well, this is really pretty awesome. You gotta love retro hacks like this. Or not really. Well, I guess it is kind of a hack to make a big...
Well, you don't have to love them, but you do have to love them when they're this pretty.
Yeah, that's true. When they're this well executed.
Right. Maple,
also,
mahogany, and walnut with dovetail joinery and mid-century modern legs.
Nice. Yeah, it's pretty excellent. And I bet you this guy just launched his career in furniture making or something. Huh?
Yeah, do you think he'll start doing... Genesis controllers or PS2 controllers?
Certainly hope so. I always preferred the Sega Genesis in the first place. So yeah, I would hope that he would switch platforms and make a Sega controller as well.
Sega!
All right. Well, that's our last story of the day, so I guess we'll get out of here. Taylor, if somebody wanted to contact you, how would they do so?
They could email me at my new email address, Taylor@thedigitalmediazone.com, or they could send me a little message on Twitter. And I am at TaylorPhone, or they could go to facebook.com/theenduser and they could find me there.
Or they could use the contact form. That would also work.
That would also work, yeah. Or I guess, I give my full name on the show so they could potentially find me on Facebook.
Yeah, potentially. All right, well, yeah, that's all the ways to contact us. I'm at Chris Hale Barnes if you want to leave me a message of some sort. So thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. And, of course, you can find more information at our website. That's thedigitalmediazone.com. We are under the End User tab. That's thendusr.com. And, of course, the DMZ has other podcasts. You can have a look at Entertainment 2.0, Scene in HD, and the Movie Podcast. And as we mentioned, you can leave us some feedback. TheEndUser@thedigitalmediazone.com is the general purpose address, and you can ping us on Twitter @TheEndUser. We broadcast live every Wednesday night starting at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Taylor Marr.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.